Welcome. You are listening to the UC Davis Center for Poverty Research Seminar Series. I'm the Center's Director, Ann Stevens. This series brings scholars and policy experts from around the country to discuss their work on poverty and poverty research. In April 2013, we hosted Sean Corcoran, an Associate Professor of Educational Economics at New York University's Steinhardt School and an affiliated faculty of the Robert F. Wagner School of Public Service. His research focuses on several areas in the economics of education, including teacher labor markets. Here is Corcoran presenting his seminar, The Effect of Breakfast in the Classroom on Obesity and Academic Performance, evidence from New York City.
So this is a paper on a Breakfast in the Classroom program in New York City that's also been implemented in a number of other school districts in the U.S. And we're looking at the effects of this program on both obesity and as well as academic performance. And it's joint work with Liz DiBraggio, who's going to Northwestern as a PhD student next year, Brian Elbel, who's with the medical school at NYU and the Wagner School, and Amy Ellen Schwartz, who's also at the Wagner School and Steinhardt School at NYU. So lots of affiliations there. This is actually part of a bigger project. As I said, something that's pretty new for me. And it's an NIH-funded project that involves a number of different papers. There's the Breakfast in the Classroom paper, which I'll be talking about today. We have a paper that's under review right now that's looking at the effect of moving to universal free breakfast provision in New York City and its impact on participation in the school breakfast program. Hopefully that will be forthcoming soon. We have a third paper that's probably going to go to a JAMA type journal or a New England Journal of Medicine that just sort of attempts to quantify the extent to which there are neighborhood or school effects on obesity in New York City, and so how much of the variation, say, in obesity rates can be explained by census tracts or schools versus individual student characteristics. And we're finding that the potential for neighborhood or school-based interventions to reduce the citywide obesity rate are pretty limited, and so that's just kind of a descriptive exercise in that paper. We're also conducting a survey. We're actually collecting data from schools in New York City on their own school food policies around serving breakfast, around physical activity, lunch, allowing competitive foods to come into the schools, that sort of thing. It's modeled after a similar survey done by the USDA. And then once that data is in, we're going to be doing a series of kind of exploratory studies on how, those policies are related to obesity or potentially academic outcomes and achievement, attendance, and what have you. What really underlies all of this is our access to this richly detailed FitnessGram data in New York City. And a FitnessGram, I'll just explain in a few minutes, is just an annual taking of kids' height and weight, calculating their BMI, asking them to go through a set of routine fitness exercises, and they record all this. And New York City has about 1.1 million kids, and so they're collecting this longitudinally on basically every kid in New York City. And so we have that data for about 5 or 6 years, and it's linkable to the achievement data. Many of you are probably familiar with the school breakfast program. It began in 1966. It's less popular, I suppose, than the lunch program, even among kids that are eligible to participate in the program. The participation rates are often much lower. For example, in New York City, about one-third of all students take a breakfast every day, even though it's been free for all students in the city since 2003. And many kids, 3 out of 4 kids in New York City are poor and eligible for free meals anyway, so the need is there, but they're not taking a free breakfast that's available to them. A study by FRAC, the Food Research and Action Center, something like that, documented that New York City actually had the lowest ratio of breakfast to lunch participation among 26 urban districts that it looked at. So it's seen as a problem in New York City, but it's an issue elsewhere as well. Why it's so low in New York City is sort of a topic for a future paper, but we have some ideas.
New York City, thinking about the 5 boroughs.
The 5 boroughs. Yep. So only Manhattan. We don't look beyond. New York does not extend beyond the bridges. Potentially, part of the reason why participation is so low in the breakfast program is that breakfast is offered before school hours, and so you have to actually make an effort to get to school before school starts. It's also served in the cafeteria, and so there's some stigma that comes along with that, that you have to show up and identify yourself as someone who's in need of a free breakfast before school, and so that comes with its own dynamics. Whereas breakfast in the classroom, as the name suggests, actually provides breakfast in the classroom during the first 10 or 20 minutes of school. Sorry. And so it's delivered in usually a package like this. So there's kind of a grab and go type mechanism where kids will come in the classroom and they'll grab a banana and a bagel and a juice and take it to their desk. And then after 10 or 20 minutes, they'll be clean up and move on.
Issues having to do with busing, getting kids to school.
The bus strike?
Controversies. I don't think it was a strike. It was.
There was a bus strike.
What it was. So my question, where I'm vague about that.
Yeah.
It was because of the strike. But how many kids take the bus to school? When do they get there? Is that part of the story? That
I'm sure it's part of the.
Positive there at 2 minutes before class starts.
I'm sure it's part of the story. We haven't quantified that yet. The nice thing about the Office of School Food, which provided us a lot of this data, is that they also handle the transportation, and so they can provide us those numbers. I think a much smaller fraction of kids take the bus to school in New York than what you would find in other urban districts.
Question, which is why I thought it was odd, whatever this issue was that I'm having trouble remembering.
Yep. They do, like for high school kids, they offer subway cards and bus cards,
sure.
And so there's free transportation, but kids are often on their own to get to school in a lot of parts of the city. And so we think that's an issue. We have data on school starting times and things like that, and we're starting to look at heterogeneous effects or see how participation varies with school starting time. But
the variation in what fraction of the kids take the bus versus,
yes.
Yeah.
That data we don't have yet on buses.
Mean something different for ability to get there?
Absolutely. And anecdotally, and what we see in the data too, is that the school starting times are getting earlier over time. And in some parts of the city, they've broken up large high schools into smaller units, and they stagger their starting times. And so some kids are starting school, at 7:15 in the morning. And so that, I couldn't get there on time for breakfast.
Yeah, quick question on who determines sort of what goes into these?
The Office of School Food, there's very little latitude yet. It's centralized.
There's no heterogeneity across sort of classrooms and what's offered?
I'm sure there's some heterogeneity.
Yeah.
There's a citywide menu that they're supposed to draw from. But there are, like, with respect to the earlier question, across the five boroughs, there's some different vendors, and so, in Manhattan, the yogurt might be organic, and in the Bronx, it might, but they're very, they're very similar. And I think I have an example of the menu. Oh, so in terms of, like, the content of what the kids are getting for breakfast, they're similar between what they would have had in the absence of breakfast in the classroom and the BIC program, except that the BIC program provides mostly prepackaged foods, and so there's nothing that's prepared on site. It's all something you can throw into one of these insulated containers the night before. And here's, I guess you probably can't read this, but this is a typical breakfast in the classroom menu, and so there's things like cinnamon cream cheese bagel full. I'm not sure what a bagel full is, but I don't want to try it. Seasonal fruit, cornbread, cheese sticks, that kind of thing. Juice is all very typical. Cereal and milk is available most every day. And then you can contrast this to the cafeteria menu, which you also can't make out. But these are things that can be prepared in a cafeteria. So things like an omelet. There is a fluffy pancakes with Canadian bacon, syrup. That sort of thing. I've done a very non-scientific comparison of the nutritional content of these two. All of the information is online for each menu. In terms of calories, they're very similar. The thing that I noticed that stood out was the protein content was a little bit different here versus in the classroom. The carbs seem to be a little bit higher in the BIC program versus the. I think the sugar content is higher in the breakfast in the classroom for sure. But again, that's a very unscientific analysis of the menus. So this program has lots of goals. I mean, fundamentally, this is about increasing participation in the breakfast program, which is low. It eliminates the need to have to come early to school. It potentially removes the stigma of having to show up to the cafeteria and take your free meal. It's supposed to ensure that all students have access to what could be considered a healthy breakfast if you think the bagel full is healthy. Potentially eating a regular meal at the same time every day of similar size and content can help you facilitate a healthy weight rather than staggering, skipping breakfast, having a large lunch, that sort of thing. It could be good for maintaining a healthy weight. Advocates of the program also argue that this provides an opportunity for teachers to say a few words about what kids are eating and why apples are good for you, or that sort of thing, integrate nutrition to the curriculum. Teachers anecdotally say that when kids are fed, that they tend to act better in class. There's fewer trips to the nurse's office. May improve attendance, and then cognitive performance and learning, to the extent that being fed can help you throughout the school day. Obesity is really high among school kids. It's like 21.
Is that higher than the first?
It's higher than the national average. And yeah.
And then higher or lower. But they're also especially poor, these
yes.
New York City kids.
Right.
So.
Yes. Conditional on SES? That's a really good question. That's a really good question.
And then I guess question two is, this is not like pretty blunt as it were, in terms of time allocation, because, you know, presumably, when you're eating your banana, you're not, you know, wiring your neurons in more directly academically.
Yeah. So what was the question?
So, is there discussion of the trade-off in terms of class time allocation?
Yes. So that's also an issue. In New York City, I'll say in a few seconds, this is actually a bigger topic of conversation in New York City than you might think of this breakfast and classroom program. And on the whole, it's teachers there are in favor of the program. But if you go online and look at the discussion in Los Angeles, the teachers are totally opposed to it. And so the teachers union has a yes, yep. And so teachers they say they're not paid to be distributing food, and it takes away from class time, and it's messy, and you know, so. The crowding out class time is a.
But that sounds almost like the concern isn't so much about crowding out class time as like labor relations.
Totally. But they mention crowding out class time as a concern. Yeah.
You may have said this already. Was the emphasis for this program because take up rates were so low?
Yes.
Okay.
Yep.
And my thought was this would reduce it.
Yeah.
And was it contentious at the time it was started, or is it more in.
In New York City, it started very quietly. So the first implementation was in 2007. No one was talking about it then. Schools were adopting this program, and
so sort of a school decision about whether to adopt it. Or
yes. Yeah. So our design is going to be looking at the same schools over time, like similar students in the same schools over time. But they absolutely can choose. It was not a citywide decision to adopt this. Approach, whereas some other districts, they have done that. So it only became contentious really in the last year, and I'll tell you why. There's a lot of evidence out there that having breakfast or the quality or content of your breakfast can actually affect your cognitive performance. So there's randomized experiments where they'll give kids, you know, tea versus a cereal, or no, they'll skip a breakfast, and they'll, you know, and they'll find that kids do better on cognitive tasks when they're fed. And when they're fed something like cereal versus something like, you know, just tea. Yes. Yes. Starving kids for the greater good. And there are actually two studies, you know, as often seems to happen, two studies recently came out on the Breakfast in the Classroom program, both by economists, that have found actually pretty substantial effects of this Breakfast in the Classroom program on achievement, standardized test performance, and in another paper on behavior. And I'll come back and just say a little more about those papers in a few minutes. But there's been no look at how the Breakfast in the Classroom program has affected obesity or student health more generally. You know, I've given you sort of the positive story as to why the Breakfast in the Classroom program might be good for kids' health and their weight. But there's also a concern that it could be bad. I mean, if what kids are getting with the BIC breakfast is actually worse than what they might consume otherwise, or as Mayor Bloomberg, who is our obesity mayor, believed, he temporarily halted the expansion of this program because he saw this as an opportunity for kids to have two breakfasts. And there was an internal study that found that 21% of kids in these BIC schools were having two breakfasts every day, right? Which is not good for obesity. And this was a very small sample of schools, and I've never actually seen the study. They circulated an abstract, and so I can't say much about the methodology or anything of the study, but that was enough for Bloomberg to put the brakes on this program. He's relaxed a little bit in the last few months, as I understand it, in part because Tom Vilsack, the U.S. DA secretary, came and actually spoke out in favor of breakfast in the classroom, in particular to eliminate some of the stigma associated with the school breakfast program. And the city council is all in favor of this, and anyone that's considering running for mayor is all behind the breakfast in the classroom program. Gives them an issue, I guess.
Just ask a question on the cost of the program.
Yes.
Who's paying for it, and is that viewed as an issue?
I've only seen one analysis of the cost, and I think it's kind of a wash, and if anything, it might be cheaper. It's still paid for out of federal subsidies, but I think if anything, it's probably less expensive to deliver. You're not paying for labor to prepare a meal in the cafeteria. You don't have to open up the school as early, perhaps. So I think it's less expensive.
So the schools that do breakfast in the classroom aren't doing hot breakfast before?
There's a mix. And so some schools went entirely from cafeteria to breakfast in the classroom. Some phased it in some grades, but not in others. And so they still presumably had a cafeteria in operation, and some were exclusively cafeteria. Space is very limited in New York City, and so there are some schools where they don't have a cafeteria, and their practice before was to warm up things that were brought in. And so for them, they never really had the cafeteria operation, but big schools have them. Someone asked, actually, in the last time I gave this talk, whether kids can have two breakfasts at school if they show up to the cafeteria and somehow collect it in the classroom as well, and that I don't know.
Well, actually, another one on that would be, if classes have absentees, do the kids get to take two bananas?
Yeah. I mean, technically, no. So there's subject to all the same rules about federal reimbursement, and so the teachers are supposed to ensure that kids get, you know, you're not supposed to take less than what you're like a federally subsidized breakfast includes a range of things, and so you can't just say I'll have the bagel full today. You have to take the bagel full, the banana, and the juice, the full package. You don't have to eat it, but you have to take it. And for reimbursement purposes, they have to keep track of how many are taken, and presumably kids can't have two. But these are teachers that are administering these. So, is there another? No. So what we're going to do is it's very straightforward. This program was introduced in a staggered fashion throughout the city. It wasn't done at random. These are schools that opted into the program based on their own decisions. But it happens in slowly over time. We're going to look at the relationship between the introduction of this program and first of all, meals program participation. So did it even affect kids' take-up of subsidized meals? Using the FitnessGram data, we'll look at effects on obesity and BMI. We're also looking at the impacts on achievement, the state tests in English language arts and mathematics, attendance. And then we have a student-level survey where they answer questions about the school environment, so I feel welcome in this school, I feel safe in class, that sort of thing, just with the hopes that maybe if this program really is building any community within the classroom, that maybe we might be able to detect that in this survey. And we do find some small effects there.
Looking at the bottom line, it looks like the survey said very well evidence is the contemporaneous treatment.
Yes.
Rather than sort of like
cumulative.
Yeah.
Yes. Yes. We have not done the cumulative yet, but we're getting there. Yeah, it's contemporary. Yeah. The treatment is somewhat complex. So, I mean, some schools, as you'll see, the program was adopted school-wide, and so we went from a year in which the program was not offered at all to a year in which everyone in the school was given breakfast in the classroom. But there are other schools where it was introduced at the grade level, and so fifth graders might get breakfast in the classroom, but the sixth graders don't. That provides some interesting variation for us that we can use in the next step in terms of cumulative exposure to the program, but it also muddies the water just a little bit in terms of who's actually being treated in the school or given the offer to participate in breakfast in the classroom. We don't observe kids eating the food, so nutrition experts are very concerned about waste, and they say this is actually a really big issue, that kids take meals, whether it's breakfast in the classroom or school lunches, and they'll take a few bites and they'll throw it away and go to recess. And we don't observe that. All we observe is take up in our participation models. just a preview of what we find. So we find large effects of the program on participation. So participation rates in the breakfast program go way up. So it works in the sense that it actually gets more kids to take a free breakfast. We really find little evidence, if any, at least no adverse impact on obesity. A lot of the point estimates are negative, which is consistent with this idea that this food might be better than what the kids were having otherwise. It doesn't point in the direction of overeating, to breakfast, that sort of thing. But most of them are statistically insignificant.
Are you thinking for the denominator participation as total students, or
it's average daily attendance?
Okay. Are you going to be able to separate that out into three students versus one?
I'll tell you if you'd like to know. I'll tell you why that's hard to do. So they report it as they report that participation by free, reduced, and full price. Which is great because it splits them up into income categories. But what they have is this thing called Provision 2, which allows schools to opt in and not keep records, basically, on kids' status and just provide free meals to everyone, lunch and breakfast. And in those cases, they lock in the counts of, they just keep those ratios the same, free, reduced, and full, and that carries forward for like 4 or 5 years and sometimes more. And so it's not a real measure of participation by those groups. But I'll say one more thing, and that's that the Office of School Food has been really cooperative with us, and they actually have point-of-sale data for a number of schools where kids use swipe cards. And so we can actually, in the future, we'll have student-level data on participation, which will be something I've never seen before in these kinds of papers.
On that, specifically the thing you're talking about, I understand that the deforms impact of us. People would love to see something. What scale this by? Like, what is the impact on calories consumed into breakfast?
Yeah.
And if you turn this into like an outcome per calorie.
Right.
It seems like you have all sorts of magic connections and endless pools of resources. In some sense, to do some sort of like small sort of counting exercise, or waist weighing exercise at multiple schools to get some sense about average flows and even if not marginal flows.
That's a great idea, and we have great relationships right now with Office of School Food. I'd love to hear more about how you think we might do that.
Yeah.
Yeah, the nice thing about the Office of School Food is no one ever comes knocking on their door, and so the the achievement people, the labor market, wealth, they have to turn people away all the time. The Office of School Food, or come on in. And one of the the common findings, especially with BMI and obesity, is that the effects seem to vary by gender and grade level. Actually, the achievement effects go that way too, and so we're not quite sure what the story is there. This might be a place for nutritionists to weigh in. Boys and girls may have different calorie requirements at different ages, and so providing them the same kind of meal every day may have differential effects. And so I'll show you this.
I don't spend a lot of time reading food over lunch or breakfast for them. Is the idea here really about calories, or is the idea about improving the quality of food?
I think much more the latter. I mean, when this program was initially adopted, I mean, not BIC, but school lunch program and school breakfast program, it was all about food insecurity, and kids weren't getting fed at all. Now I think that's much less of an issue. Like, we don't see many kids that were classified as underweight, but we see lots of obesity. And so,
I think I'm stuck on this whole two breakfast thing. In my head, I'm thinking, yeah, maybe they eat two breakfasts, but at least this way, one story
yes.
you could tell is the breakfast at home is crap and the breakfast
right.
at school is, of course, you could also imagine it going the other way.
Yes.
But
and it varies by SES for sure.
I've seen the bananas.
Yeah. Well, one thing, I've presented this a couple times, and every time there's someone who has some much more intimate knowledge of these kinds of programs than I do, and there's someone who worked in LA where this was being done and said that the kids that were really hungry would actually, they would get two breakfasts, and they would take, even just the one breakfast, and they would take it home, and it would be their dinner. So, they might get breakfast at home, but they didn't, they were unsure about whether they would have dinner, and so they took their breakfast home. Anecdotal, but so the first paper on this list, actually, on on this look at the literature kind of speaks to that. So this paper by Bhattacharya, Curry, and Hayter, they're using the NHANES data, and they find that the school breakfast program didn't really alter the amount of calories that kids were consuming at breakfast time, but there was big effects on the quality. So at least for those participating in this survey, there were big differences in the quality of what was being consumed when it was at school versus at home. And that's using, I think, not time diaries, but, you know, meal diaries. Another paper finds, the second one on the list, finds that the school breakfast program leads to a reduction in the likelihood of eating breakfast, which by comparing weekdays and weekends, but I'm not sure what to make of that one. And the latter two speak to the obesity relationship between school meal programs and obesity. So Diane Schonzenbach looks at the lunch program and finds that the school lunch program positively affects obesity because they're getting more calories with the school lunches than they would be otherwise. And this last paper by Millamet et al. Finds a similar finding for the school lunch program, but the opposite for the school breakfast program, that kids that were participating in the school breakfast program had lower obesity rates, controlling for sort of selection effects.
So the thinking is obesity is the problem, because you could have said it positively affects BMI, and that's great because that brings some people up from 15 to 20. Are you making any distinction, or is the presumption now that low weight is not a problem?
We'll look at BMI too. We look at obesity, the threshold measure, and look at BMI as well. And they're really consistent. But one thing that we would like to do is look more at different points in the distribution. Because right now what you're going to see is basically no effect on obesity and very little to no effect on BMI. But it could be a wash from things that are happening at the bottom of the distribution, the top of the distribution.
But even if the BMI goes up, if you're bringing some underweight kids up a little bit, that's probably where you're going to get the most kick in terms of performance.
Absolutely. And we, you know, overall, we don't see much a large underweight population, but the population is pretty big, and there's also a big population of recent immigrant kids, and some of those populations are more undernourished than others. In terms of educational outcomes, there's a number of papers that find that the school meals programs do have positive effects on outcomes. And so this Heinrich paper from a couple years ago finds that the introduction of the school lunch program over time in states had large effects on educational attainment, but no real measurable effects on health. And then one paper I want to mention that seems unrelated, but you'll see in a second why it's related, and that's the Stiglio and Winicki paper, which was really clever, that looked to see how schools and school districts in Virginia were responding to test-based accountability policies. And so what they found there is that schools that were sort of under a threat of closure or getting sanctions for accountability tweaked their menus in ways that improved test performance. So on test day, for example, increasing the number of calories or increasing the content of sugar in the meals actually had measurable effects on achievement. So very clever and seems hard to believe, but it's consistent, as you'll see, with some of the other stuff. And I mentioned already that...
Yeah, it's time to get gum for the kids.
Gum?
No, but we get notes on this week. It starts us week, so we get notes on. Please remember to feed your cat.
Yeah.
We did.
Yep.
We do it pretty regularly.
Related to the Figlio paper, I remember that, like, if you're just... So I'm wondering for your achievement measures if that's happening in the morning after it, because if it's just like an appeasement of more sugar or more calories, that might... No.
Okay. No, I'm saying, yes, could be. Okay. It could be. We're actually not finding very large achievement effects.
But that could be kind of a disaster because you don't want them to be doing all this because they're kind of pumped up on sugar.
Absolutely, absolutely. And it's also a case for us to look more at cumulative and longer run outcomes, which we don't quite have yet. But I wanted to say just a couple words about the two existing Breakfast in the Classroom papers. So there's two. One is by Scott Emberman and Adriana Kugler from just last year. They're looking at the introduction of Breakfast in the Classroom in a large urban district where, like in New York City, breakfast was provided free to all students prior to the introduction of the program. So the treatment here was just moving breakfast into the classroom at a different time. They look at the impact on fifth grade math and reading achievement, report card grades, and attendance. One complication, or I guess a challenge in the design of the paper, is that the rollout was very fast, and so they rolled out this program over the course of 11 weeks. And so the design was to compare kids
who were exposed to the program before the test versus kids that were exposed to the program after the test. And you know, they showed that these schools didn't differ that much in terms of observable characteristics and trends and that kind of thing, and found actually really large effects on math and reading, so about 0.1 standard deviation, and even larger for some subgroups, which is a really big effect in education. So almost unbelievable. And what harks back to the Figlio paper is that there was really no variation in the treatment effect with respect to the amount of time exposed to the program. So kids that got Breakfast in the Classroom introduced 2 weeks before the test were seeing as large of an impact as those that had got it, you know, whatever, 7-8 weeks before.
Have these folks or Figlio, or do you know, like, it seems like this might be a sort of classic thing to look at, not the low BMIs, but the low test scores, like the sort of the sort of impact on the distribution.
Yes. This paper does that, and finds bigger effects for kids towards the bottom of the distribution. So there's some things that, you know, there's some things that I don't necessarily quite like in this paper, but it's actually kind of consistent with the result in the second paper from San Diego, which is more in the spirit of our paper, as Breakfast in the Classroom was introduced over a period of 4 years, and so there's a staggered introduction. The catch with this paper is that it wasn't a universal free system before. In those Provision 2 schools, they offered free breakfast to everyone, but in other schools, there was this tiered system of subsidies and paid meals. And so Breakfast in the Classroom basically made breakfast free for everyone, and it shifted it to the classroom. So the treatment there kind of confounds both the movement into the classroom as well as a reduction in price for kids. And they find large effects, actually bigger effects on reading and math, but only in schools that had not already provided free breakfast. And so it's consistent with the Imberman finding, but the treatment there is in part moved to free breakfast as well as providing it in the classroom.
What was the in Imberman? Did they have breakfast in all the school cafeteria setting?
I believe so. Yeah. I believe so, yeah. He also had some measures of the behavior, teacher-reported behavior, and found some positive impacts there on kids' behavior in the classroom. And their methodology was very similar to ours, as kind of a difference-in-difference approach. So the limitations of these papers, you know, everything seems small when you're working with New York City data. These are relatively small samples of schools, 69 treatment and 19 control in the first, and then 44 and 22 in the second. They're focused on elementary grades. One might think that the stigma might differ if you're looking at middle school versus elementary or high school. Only the daughter paper really speaks to longer run effects versus just this within year changes. And neither speak to the obesity or health dimension. So our data is going to come from the New York City Department of Education and the Office of School Food. And we're pulling data together from a number of sources. So at the school level, we know the schools that adopted this Breakfast in the Classroom program and when. We know the grades that were served, if it was individual grades within a school. We're assuming that one issue with the measurement here is that we're assuming that those haven't changed over time. We have a snapshot in 2012. Anecdotally, they tell us there weren't that many changes, but there may have been some changes over time. We have average daily participation rates in breakfast and lunch over about a 10-year period. And then at the student level, from 07 to 2011, my co-authors are working with 2012 data, so that will be in soon. We have from the fitness gram height, weight, and these other fitness measures, test scores in ELA and math for just grades 3 to 8, all the typical background measures you find in these kinds of data sets, and then these student responses to this learning environment survey. I assume many are familiar with the kind of achievement data that's typically used in these papers, so I'll just talk about FitnessGram. It's been collected annually since 2005-06, but they've kind of ramped it up over time, so school participation was not as high in the early years as it was in later years. We're going to restrict our analysis to schools that had at least 50% of their students measured in a given year, so that's not potentially a strange population of kids within a school that are being measured. But by the end of this period, you know, we have data on almost 810,000 students in about 1,700 schools, and so there's almost complete participation then. This is the standard BMI calculation that we use, weight over height squared, scaled by 703. Obesity is defined as being above the 95th percentile for your gender and age, and it's based on a fixed point in time. We use the CDC charts from 2000, and so that's the obesity threshold. And as our measures, we're going to use that threshold as well as the Z-score for BMI, so the Z-score for your age and gender. And as I said, obesity is a problem in the New York City schools, so 21% classified as obese and 44% are classified as overweight or obese. Yes, yes, and I actually don't like that very much, but we have the parameters that they use in the CDC charts, and so we're going to estimate them using some national Z scores.
Is there any variation across schools in when the fitness gram is administered during the school year?
Yes, yes. You know, which is not bad for us because we have the date of measurement. And so we haven't exploited that to the extent that we could. You know, there's a lot, there's even just like you said, we have contemporaneous measures of participation, but there's also variation in the amount of time in a given year that you've been exposed to that program. And so we know the dates, but yes, there is variation. This is the rollout of the program. This is just the number of schools adopting in each month. Our data until a couple months from now only runs through 2010, 2011. So we have all of these schools in our data, but they would continue to be rolled out in 11, 12. On a cumulative basis, this was the implementation of the program. So the plateau when Bloomberg decided he didn't like the program kind of occurs at the end of that last year.
I'm Ann Stevens, the director of the Center for Poverty Research at UC Davis, and I want to thank you for listening. The center is one of three federally designated poverty research centers in the United States. Our mission is to facilitate nonpartisan academic research on domestic poverty, to disseminate this research, and to train the next generation of poverty scholars. Core funding comes from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. For more information about the center, visit us online at poverty.ucdavis.edu.